we are doing what we need to and what we can to support the mission. The mission of freedom, the mission of independence, the mission of mass Bitcoin adoption.
Until that generation has to like learn the hard lesson that personal responsibility is really important and their kids grow up seeing the suffering of not taking personal responsibility.
The messaging is at least buy Bitcoin. That's good. And hopefully enough of us can get in front of them and say, buy real Bitcoin into self-custody. And then it's like, you're there. And so if Saylor and this corporate play gets them 2/3 the way and we bring them the last third, hallelujah.
Do you not understand Bitcoin, or do you just acknowledge you're speculating and that that speculation carries with it a lot of counterparty risk?
Oh, I want to wait for a 4% drop before I buy. I think there's going to be some news in 2 weeks and CNN's going to say something and Trump's going to respond and we're going to see a market correction of 4%. No. Quit playing these trader games, man. Like, just buy your generational wealth, hold it properly, and do it again next week.
Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have Adam O'Brien, CEO and founder of Bitcoin Well. We got to discuss our experiences at the Bitcoin conference, bumped into each other several times there, and get to hear his thoughts on treasuries, lending products, all of these things that people are talking about. I think he and I tend to align on a lot of it. He gives a bit more nuance and tends to be more gracious and bullish on some of these aspects than I do, but overall, very fun conversation. You'll also like some of his commentary on what he's seen as a non-custodial exchange operator in terms of Bitcoin adoption and the buys he's seen coming in, his thoughts on price suppression, all of that good stuff. I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I've got Adam here. Adam, welcome back to the Bitcoin Way podcast. How are you, man?
Great, man. Every time I see you, I just want to tell you that I think you are the real Michael Jordan. And I think that other guy who just does some sport things, he can be the other Michael Jordan. So just I'll just start there.
I'm touched. I like to imagine that I have more Bitcoin than him, but I'm concerned that Scottie Pippen, who was at the conference, may have gotten to him and there's no way of knowing. Maybe he's like a closet buyer now and Michael Jordan's stacking sats, doing his full spin at
hopefully
night.
Hopefully buying real Bitcoin and not paper Bitcoin like these other billionaires that are paper Bitcoin.
A man can dream. I like to think that he's upholding the namesake. So hey man, we ran into each other a few times at the conference, fun times. Why don't you give your thoughts on the conference? We're going to jump into sort of the topics that were covered very heavily there. And I understand that you're a sponsor, you guys had a booth there, so you've got to perhaps approach it with some level of caution or care.
Oh no man, I'm off the rails. I say my mind regardless of who's paying us or who we're paying. So no one has to fear with me.
Okay.
But in all honesty, so like conferences from my perspective, first and foremost, I loved being there to run into you and the, dozens of other people that I kind of see once or twice a year, usually at conferences. And so like I only went to one talk and I'm sure we'll talk about that later, but I'm not there to learn anything. I've been in the industry 12 years. Like, I don't need to go see some, guy on stage talk about treasury. This conference certainly felt to me like the step towards it being an industry conference. And I think that in hindsight, and I actually said this maybe a few years ago, there won't be Bitcoin conferences in the future. Just like there are not toilet, like you and I don't go to toilet conferences, but there are toilet conferences that exist. And it's like just the people that work in the toilet industry go and learn about new toilet things. A few years ago, we went to an ATM conference. It was for people who are in the ATM industry. And Bitcoin will inevitably get there because like my kids are just going to look at Bitcoin as like, that's the money. Like, we don't go to, I don't think you've ever been to a banking conference or a fintech conference or a fiat money conference. I can't imagine what that would be. Probably just a bunch of like, I was going to go down the pedophile route, but I'll just leave that alone. but like, Bitcoin conferences were largely just Bitcoiners getting together and learning and innovating and talking about new stuff in the industry. But eventually that won't be the case. or maybe it will be the case, but it won't be at, you know, these massive conferences. This was a corporate event. The biggest sponsors there were public companies and public miners. I think miners probably paid half the bill for that massive conference. It was largely a pay-to-play speaking environment. I was very proud to be asked to speak. So while I did not get paid to speak, I did not pay to speak. They asked me to speak before we sponsored the conference. So I'm just going to put that out there. And then it was other industries, other companies in the industry that were paying to get access to what I would describe as the new Bitcoiners, the next generation Bitcoiners, the one that are going to have like class of 2025 in their Twitter bio in like a year and a half. It was kind of those people that we were trying to go and see and meet and empower our brand through. So yeah, from my perspective, if I'm a pleb deep down the Bitcoin Twitter sphere, I think it's cool because you get to go there and meet most of the Bitcoin influencers or celebrities that you enjoy talking to. Like, you know, we're obviously friends corporately, and I'm personally friends with like the Simply Bitcoin crew, and they're getting mobbed down the hallway. They can't take 10 steps without getting a picture taken. I'm sure you're getting people like looking for pictures and giving you high fives, and other influencers, you know, like Julian and Issa walking around filming, getting interviews with people. Like, it's definitely a spot where you can go and hang out, but I don't know how much like value is coming out of the talks. And I think back to even like I was at Adopting Bitcoin in El Salvador this November, so almost a year, about a half a year ago. And I was there was great speakers, good lineup, but there was no one really listening to the speeches, no one really listening to the conversations, the panels, and the talks. It's mostly people congregating in the common areas, chatting, connecting. You know, we work in a borderless environment and we've got borderless money, but the meat space still exists. Our connection still exists in the meat space. And the conferences, I think, that are going to succeed in the future are the ones that really capture that. So yeah, my perspective on the conference, like everyone's like, oh, it was full of scams and stuff. Like, I mean, I'm kind of like, what did you expect? Like, you know, you think a bunch of hardened Bitcoin maxis are going to go and spend thousands of dollars on a ticket to walk around and talk to other hardened Bitcoin maxis? Like, no, we've got Bitcoin Twitter for that. Those guys got to pay the bills, and you can call me an apologist or whatever, but it's like, it was exactly what I expected, which is the largest congregation of like-minded individuals kind of on the early stage of their Bitcoin journey. And I think that for the Bitcoin conference to kind of cement that in their repertoire is probably fine. And hopefully 99 to 100% of them turn into hardened Bitcoin maxis that maybe don't see value in that conference in 2, 3, 4, 5 years, but find value in adopting Bitcoin in El Salvador, find value, you know, going to like more technical community events around Bitcoin that are smaller. Maybe they start a Bitcoin event in their city. So that's kind of how I feel about that conference in particular.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think it's like having the opportunity to meet clients, to run into each other and talk in the hallway. And, you know, there are a lot of good connections made. I was at my first like Bitcoin conference, like this conference was last year, actually. And I think I'd only been to one before that, Pacific Bitcoin in 23. And nice. It's amazing the difference a year makes of going deeper down the rabbit hole. Like last year, I was like, oh, like Lynn's going to be here. Sailor's going to be here. I like sat in and listened to all these talks and like, you know, sitting on the edge of my seat. And this year I was like, I've heard Sailor like whatever, like I'm going to go, you know, I'm going to go run and, you know, try to meet a couple more clients before they shut down the expo area or something. So it was good for that. Yeah. And I agree with you. I think you maybe have given me a more empathetic angle toward, some of the annoying, exhibitors and people who were there. A lot of noise, a lot less signal, but I think at the end of the day, like what I'm happy about, I'm glad I went. I'm glad I got to meet a lot of the people I did. I got tons of great podcasts lined up, connected with our partners. You know, it's just, really good people. And when you step outside of like all the noise around the politics and stable coins and all these, you know, blah, 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 just sort of talking heads.
Yeah, man. Know, I mean, if you think about it, like, I think Pacific Bitcoin probably was the largest, best signal, but they're not around anymore. And there's a reason for that.
Yeah,
it's like
pretty
hard to run a mass scale event with only high signal. Because guess what? Signal doesn't pay.
You're right.
It's very
right.
low time preference. And you know, I'm really happy that the Bitcoin community still went in spite of or despite the, you know, the noise. Like I met, like similar to you, piles of people that I would have probably never met otherwise, or maybe would have met way later down the road, who are like unfathomably based, have an amazing product. You know, we're working on collaborations, we're working on future deals. And both of us agree, like, this is not, you know, the politics I could kind of care less about, the corporate treasury stuff. It's like, okay, it feels like this cycle's ICO or this cycle's NFT, but it is what it is. And all this like, oh, boycott, virtue. It's just like virtue signaling. It's kind of just like, hey, go there with your intention, spread the good news, you know, despite the chaos, despite the noise, call out what is wrong if you see fit. But like, let's be honest, people are coming to Bitcoin and people are furthering their Bitcoin journey because of that conference. And hopefully we adopt a first principle mindset where, you know, we agree that more people coming to Bitcoin and then finding their ability to navigate in and around the noise, the better. And so I'm pro that. I think the future of high signal conferences is going to be smaller events. I know in Calgary up here near where I live, you know, the Bitcoin Rodeo is about to happen. That is always a high signal event. Awesome. It's only panels, no solo speeches. Last year, we roasted BTC Sessions, which if anyone watching knows BTC Sessions and his history, it was amazing. I got to play Roastmaster, so I'm obviously biased, but we had JP Sears out. It was just like a bunch of Freedom Bitcoin Maxis roasting Ben for an hour and a half, which is hilarious. But then around that, there was great panels around Bitcoin for businesses, you know, Bitcoin versus gold, you know, the future of Bitcoin tech and merchant adoption, blah, blah, blah. But it's only 300 people. And the reason it's 300 people is because those events or those spaces cost less and the tickets cost less and you need less sponsors. And it's just a lot easier to run a smaller event. And so I feel like, you know, once again, aligned incentives, holy smokes, Bitcoin has it perfect. It's like, let's decentralize that community. Probably no one's going to fly from Australia to come to the 300 person event in Calgary, but that's okay. Someone can just make a 300 person event in Australia or in Europe or, you know, in one of the countries in Europe, in South America. Like we can do these smaller high signal events without some mass congregation. And so I think that's probably where the future of conferences go. I know that for us corporately, this was like the Bitcoin conference was the number one event we've ever done from an ROI perspective. We made great relationships. We're a non-custodial Bitcoin platform. So, you know, we're putting those customers on the right path. And I'm generally optimistic. I'm generally like just, you know, more Bitcoin's better. And I'm also pro, but I'm also pro like self-accountability. And so, yeah, I would say that's kind of my position on that.
All righty. You already alluded to your take on one of the topics I wanted to hit, and that is the hype around Bitcoin treasury companies. You suggest that perhaps that's this cycle's ICO or whatever the case may be.
Totally.
What do you explain your stance on that? Or maybe fully flesh out your thoughts and then, you know, give me your thoughts on how that might play out.
Yeah. So if we look historically, what gives us all-time highs also rugs us. What also takes it away? Even back to like, I found Bitcoin in spring of 2013. And that was right around when Mt. Gox kind of gained worldwide like popularity. And so, you know, Bitcoin's $1 a couple years ago. I heard about Bitcoin in and around some Mt. Gox discussion, and it was $100. And then it shoots up to $1,000 over the course of that year. And then Mt. Gox is like hacked or, you know, inside job or whatever you want to call it. And price collapse. And so you can kind of, it stands to reason like, oh, hey, Bitcoin for the first time got mass worldwide liquidity for retail. And then that retail liquidity kind of disappeared because they had problems and they were hacked and all this stuff. And so, boom, price fell. Everyone sold. And then, okay, a couple of years go along, and then like, you know, the ICOs come out and everyone's aping in to get the next, you know, public company on the blockchain. There's that company. Someone just posted it on Twitter and I loved it. There was a Long Island iced tea company that changed their name to Blockchain Iced Tea, and their stock pumped like 2,000% or something really stupid, like just hilarious. And so this kind of ICO stuff kickstarts the bull run in 2017. And then, oh, what do you know? They're illegal and ICOs are mostly scams, or all scams, I guess. And then boom, you know, rug pull. And then what do we have? We have FTX and meme coins and NFTs kind of like pumping us in 2021, 2022. And then like, oh, hey, turns out all this stuff is also scams. And also the guy at the head of making this stuff liquid is also a fraudster and a scammer. And boom, you know, we've got the drop. And so it's like, well, what's causing the rise this time? It's like Sailor, Jack, and, you know, a handful of VCs now pumping money into buy Bitcoin. I'm literally seeing people saying, I'm selling Bitcoin to buy MicroStrategy. I'm selling Bitcoin to buy XYZ company. And to me, that feels a little bit like, I'm selling Bitcoin to buy this monkey picture. I'm selling Bitcoin to buy this meme coin, this Trump coin, this, you know, Hawk-Tua coin, like whatever it's going to be. And so, you know, and then now the fun begins. It's like, do we decouple? Does history not rhyme with itself? Is this different for some reason? You know, oh, we're regulated now. Oh, we've got more stuff to our advantage because we're bigger and better and smarter and wiser. Maybe. But historically, every 4 years, there's a catalyst event that forces everything to run up. And then there's a black swan event that causes everything to drop. And so let's look at what's causing everything to run up, and then let's wait and see.
Yeah, it's usually two sides of the same coin, you know. It's interesting because my stance on the treasury companies is, I think it's evolved. I've become a little less hardened. As like, I think early on I was like, early on I was like, oh, Sailor's buying tons of Bitcoin, like, yeah, I'm so excited. Like, and then the further into it, I'm like, okay, who cares? I think I've come around to where I'm okay. Good, corporations are here. I want as much adoption before the government gets to it, whether it's corporations, businesses, you know, small businesses, families, what have you. I think what really confuses me is the people who I would otherwise assume understand Bitcoin, who are, to your point, selling Bitcoin to buy MicroStrategy or just foregoing purchases of Bitcoin to buy MicroStrategy. I understand the, you know, the fringe case. I've got a retirement account. I can't buy Bitcoin, you know, whatever. But like, all you're doing is investing in a speculative fiat product. The fact that he's buying Bitcoin, not even on your behalf, there's no IOU, there's none of that. Like, do you not understand Bitcoin, or do you just acknowledge you're speculating and that speculation carries with it a lot of counterparty risk?
I think it's that. I also think there's a bit of logic leaping going on of like, fiat's guaranteed to die. Sailor is stacking up fiat debt and buying Bitcoin, so there's an infinite money glitch. But what they forget is that their MSTR is fiat. And so like, when the system collapses, there is kind of just, like you said, no IOU, no like bond. It's kind of just, it's just gone. And let me be clear, like, Bitcoin Well owns Bitcoin on the balance sheet. We're publicly traded. There are like I'm in this same boat. I recommend zero people like sell their Bitcoin to buy our stock. In fact, my message is always, if you want to support our platform and succeed along with us, then you can buy the stock. But it's because we've like, the difference in my mind is the fact that we are doing what we need to and what we can to support the mission. The mission of freedom, mission of independence, the mission of mass Bitcoin adoption. And if that resonates with you and you want to put some firepower behind that mission, then let's go. Buy the stock, benefit with us, help us grow, help us market, help us produce amazing products, and then off we go. And our promise to you is that we're going to buy a little bit of Bitcoin to make sure that this company doesn't go, you know, like tits up, you right, know, right, when, right. when times are up. We save, like the company saves in Bitcoin, just like I personally recommend and my children and you probably recommend people save in Bitcoin. And companies are and individuals are kind of no different that way. But in no way am I thinking it's a good move to for people to like sell their generational wealth and lock it up. You know, my thesis is such that Bitcoin is 20% price appreciation, 80% freedom. And if you're just chasing green candles, then you're kind of giving up 80% freedom. And that's, I think that's a miss long-term. And hey, people are going to time it. People are going to get lucky. People are going to be smart and time it perfectly. And kudos, good on you, like props, right? But I think it's good to have a level, low time preference, balanced head about this with like the government at any time in 6102, your MSTR. And it cannot do Bitcoin in self-custody. So that's like a good thing to acknowledge, I think. And I my last thought on that is probably I have the same thoughts around these treasury companies as I do the Bitcoin conference that we just talked about. It's like more people are hearing the word Bitcoin and hopefully putting their first principle hat on to think, you know, why is Bitcoin good? Why is this guy yelling everywhere, fiat's going to fail? What does that mean? You know, should I buy MSTR? And then hopefully the conversation turns into, should I just buy Bitcoin? Why am I like, oh, this flywheel's done. Oh, you know, whatever. Maybe I should just buy Bitcoin. And so I think that's positive. Like, again, there's going to be info and grifters and all kinds of weird signal coming in. The best possible scenario is that we think about things from a first principle perspective and that we acknowledge individuals are hearing about Bitcoin solely because of MSTR. That's good. The messaging is at least buy Bitcoin. That's good. And hopefully enough of us can get in front of them and say, buy real Bitcoin into self-custody. And then it's like, you're there. And so if Saylor and this corporate play gets them 2/3 the way and we bring them the last third, hallelujah, right? Thank you very much. And off we go. I just hope enough people get there.
You said a couple of things I think are important. One of them is Bitcoin's, you know, 20% number go up and then the rest is the sovereignty, the freedom. And I think that is what seems to be missed. Like the greed index on the fiat products backed by Bitcoin is really high at the moment, it seems. And that's my concern. I think you're probably just more optimistic on people than I am, which is maybe why we would differ on, I think that, because I've heard this said, well, like the ETFs, people are going to like buy some of the ETFs, put in a retirement account, see it go up, and then get curious about Bitcoin. And I'm like, I don't think that's how most people operate. I think most people are like, sweet, I'm winning. Yeah, like I've got ETFs. And like, they don't even know that there's this whole rabbit hole that they can go down. They just kind of won this little speculative bet on, you know, Bitcoin number go up and probably stick in, you know, until the 6102 to your sign, you know, or whatever the threat is or Coinbase hack or what have you.
Like the difference between ETFs and this corporate stuff is probably like the mouthpiece. Like at least if you're buying MicroStrategy or you're buying like 21 Mahler's new treasury, or you're buying, you know, Bitcoin Well, or Fold, like any of the other kind of corporate strategies that exist, you're probably going to follow the founders. You know, no one's following the ETF company on Twitter to see what they say about Bitcoin. Fair. And so that is a step in the right direction. You're right though. I'm an eternal optimist. I'm just like this happy go lucky, you know, things kind of work themselves out.
I completely see that, and I hope you're right. I do agree that there's I gave the ETF example. There is a distinction between someone like Saylor or you, who's always on talking about Bitcoin, and the reason you would invest in those things is because probably they've heard Adam or they've heard Saylor or they've heard, you know, whoever talking about Bitcoin, and so it intrigues them. I think that's a lot more likely to draw people in than the ETF product, where Larry Fink's head is in 1,000 places, and you know he's not. He says good things about Bitcoin here or there, but I don't think it probably sends people down the rabbit hole the way, you know, you talking about Bitcoin might. So how about these lending products? What do you think? Do you have thoughts, concerns, more optimism?
Well, yeah, optimism, yes. I think probably most things that I experience in this industry are, useful tools for a small amount of people. And my perspective on lending is that you are one brutal candle away from liquidation, always. And so I think this ethos of like never sell your Bitcoin, this ethos of like, you know, take on debt, like logically, this makes sense. What we fail to ignore is that Bitcoin is ridiculously volatile. There are 40% candles every cycle. And if you get kissed by the 40% candle of death, your stack is gone. And you would have been better. Like then you have the holy grail of you got a tax event. So that sucks. You've got less Bitcoin than you would have had if you just sold it earlier. So that sucks. And you're going to be like wounded and trying to stack it up. And so my, I think ultimately my perspective here is, borrowing against Bitcoin, there is no better collateral. And we often say that in a positive way. We retail, we plebs say that in a positive way, but that's good for the lender. That only matters for the lender. And the reason there is no better collateral, which is something that I think people don't understand, is that you can sell it instantly and it's got a 24/365 price market, right? The reason your house sucks as collateral is because it takes months to sell and it's literally the smallest market in the world. It's like one physical piece of property. Gold is better collateral, but it's kind of hard to store. And if you want to sell it in Japan, you got to ship it to Japan. So that also sucks. Bitcoin is everywhere at one time and you can sell it with the click of a button to anyone in the world. And so notice what I'm saying is a pro for the lender, not a pro for the individual. But I think the lending products can and are good tools if you've got a plan to pay the debt back down the road. If you're starting a business and you need cash, let's do it. Let's go. Bitcoin Well uses the lending services to keep some Bitcoin in our treasury and be able to invest in our future, in our business. So like, I'm not going to sit here and poo-poo the lending stuff, but I think people overuse it. I think people who use it in order to like leverage and double up, again, it can work, right? But so can chucking your whole stack on double zero at the casino, right? It's probably less risky than a double zero play. But I'd say it's more risky than just low time preference, spend within your means, be humble, stack sats. And so it's kind of just that risk scale that exists.
Yeah, I'll tell you. So here's my perspective. Maybe tell me if the way I'm framing this makes sense or if I'm missing anything relative to your opinion. Is I think that, first of all, I just tend to have an aversion to sort of fiat products. One concern is that like it incentivizes not using Bitcoin as currency. It incentivizes the perpetuation of, you know, dollars as the form of currency. I understand that people need to buy their groceries today and probably your local grocery store isn't accepting sats. So I get it. I'll try to be pragmatic. But philosophically, I think maybe it's kind of part of my issue. I think one thing you said is really important, and that is that for a small group of people, this might be helpful and make a lot of sense, aside from my sort of ideological opposition in many ways. Practically, I think for a small percentage of people, I think that it's sort of like the unrecognized risks of the treasury companies, too. It's like you're buying a fiat product. You've got, you know, what happens if Sailor gets hit by a bus? Custodial risk. Well, like layers and layers of custodial risk. Oh, I'm going to trust the auditors that the proof of reserves are real. Like you have like layers upon layers of risk that you're taking on that most people don't realize. I think the same is true with the lending products because it's not just a big red candle and, oh, I've been liquidated. It's price volatility, it's custodial risk, it's being hacked, having your KYC information exposed, it's, my cash flow that I was using to pay this off wasn't as reliable as I thought. I mean, there are dozens of risks if you really want to get nuanced about it. And so most people are very bad at risk management and evaluating those risks in their personal lives. And so while I think there are people who have very secure cash flows, sufficiently large Bitcoin stack that even if they did get liquidated, they're not like back to square one. Oh no, I just lost my 0.1 Bitcoin and now I've got to start again. So like, I understand that for someone who's maybe a whale, you know, high net worth, very reliable cash flow, you know, some sort of safety net. Okay. I worry that most people who, you know, they don't have to show a credit score, they just put up their Bitcoin as collateral, haven't really in the back of their mind done that calculation, because it is a complex calculation. And in a, you know, government default scenario, I mean, they get desperate, they look at a 6102, you know, like there's so many ways that this kind of gets hijacked intentionally or otherwise. And that's maybe my biggest concern about the lending products, practically speaking. Is that kind of a reasonable?
Yeah, no, man, 110%. I think that is, it is up to the people to do the risk management, to decide if these products are going to be something that's right for them and their bloodline and the future of their stack. And it begs the question, whose job is that in the ecosystem? And it's like us as Bitcoiners, as the, you know, the ones right now tasked or charged otherwise with educating the masses. I think fairly pointing that out is probably the right move to do. But I will say that if lending products didn't exist, then I think I think Bitcoin doesn't work as well, because lots of this transitionary period, like, let's look at a business. Business has 100K a month cash flow, melting ice cubes. They have to do something with it. Historically, what have they done? They've purchased a property that they're going to rent themselves. So they get to, you know, separate the company, property co, you know, opco rents from property co. It's kind of some money moving around. Profits sit in the property co. Hooray, hooray, hooray. But one of the reasons that works really well is because when the opco kind of has a problem, property co gets to take a big loan out and save the opco. And but properties is an obviously worse asset than Bitcoin is. And so our pitch to companies today is, hey, why go through the brain damage of owning a property when you could just own Bitcoin? And all the time they ask, well, what if we need the capital? What if we need the cash? And our answer is, you can sell it or you can borrow against it. And I feel like that's a net positive. That's getting more people through the door. And in a business sense, like thinking about things from an individual perspective always brings about this emotional reaction. At least for me, I think about like the grandkids, and I think about like the few generations and how it's just going to wreck them if people get liquidated. But when I think about companies and I think about individuals as just like, you know, corporations and individuals are kind of just all entities, I think about how important it is for companies who are going to have volatile and varying cash flows, how important it is for them to have savings, good, solid savings that they can use meaningfully in the future. And obviously you'd hope that they would just, you know, live within their means, sell the Bitcoin and then go. And I would align with your philosophical kind of internal debate there. But I do think it's nice that a company doesn't like miss out on the property kind of scenario because of Bitcoin being like a good asset to kind of back behind. So I'm probably like neutral to pro Bitcoin lending. But I do think that people just, you play fiat games, you get fiat prizes. And at the end of the day, there's a lot of fiat games going on with this lending ecosystem that exists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I, just to clarify, because again, it's just like this philosophical and this practical voice in my head at all times where I'm like trying to, you know, and I do agree with you that I think that there are going to be things that I find suboptimal that are suboptimal in certain contexts that I think are going to be useful in this transitionary period. You know, the practical reality is that most people aren't going to own their own UTXOs forever and, you know, self-custody and do everything right. And like, there's going to be some, you know, minority of people who do that and hopefully kind of carry the flag for Bitcoin into the future. So I want to clarify, like, I don't think, I have no reason to believe that Jack Maulers or anyone else is like a bad actor, right? Like, right. You know, I think he has this product. I think the, again, like the thing that he concerns me is one of the things he said in his speech. And again, this is not a knock on Jack. He said, you know, we don't need to know like what your cash flows are, what your risk, you know, your credit score, like none of that stuff. Like, we've got your Bitcoin. Like that's our collateral. And so this is where people learn the importance of personal responsibility, which is not something that most people in a fiat world have really had to contend with before. It's like, you are making this at your discretion and you give him that Bitcoin and that Bitcoin is his to take if you default on your loan. And I think I just have more like the practical side of me is like, I'm just more warning people. I think, hey, here are the potential implications. It's not just a free ride and like, oh, I've got a pretty good job. Like I can pay it, I think. It's like, no. Like that's one consideration. That's an important one. But then like, just make sure you're thinking about these other 50 variables that could factor in here. So go on.
Just one more thing on that. That's kind of popping into my head as you say that. I feel like our generation right now, we're kind of going through this really interesting discovery period of what it means to have Bitcoin in the world. And, you know, I feel like we're very lucky in a lot of ways to have the ability to really learn about and adopt Bitcoin during its infancy, during its kind of acceleration phase. I feel like we're going to make all the mistakes so that hopefully we can teach our kids, and there's an element of like passing on through generations to be able to show them what it's like. I think that the world will be a lot healthier because we make mistakes, because our generation makes mistakes with, you know, Bitcoin loans, with treasury over, which, you know, buying a treasury co instead of buying like real Bitcoin, you know, because of the NFT and debacle. The next generation will be much healthier because of it, because we will likely pass along these mistakes in education form to the next generation and say, hey, look, I also thought that it would be fine. I had a good job. I can make the payments. I wanted more Bitcoin for you. And I'm sorry, son, I lost it. And I really hope that, you know, I'm sorry that I couldn't give you the head start that I wanted to, but you can give my grandkids, your kids, the head start by working hard and stacking responsibly and spending responsibly and maybe not borrowing, or at least borrowing more responsibly. And so I feel like, you know, I'll say something pretty crude here. I don't know how to quite say it not crude, but it's like, you know, our grandfathers went to war and taught our parents and us what it means to have physical freedom. They saw the battlefield. They have a really deep connection to the opposing side of war and to guns and to weapons and to the and to human beings as a result. And we're sat here, and this is where it gets kind of weird in my head, but like, we're sat here, you know, going to war. This is not even close to as dangerous, not even close to as bad, not even close to as taxing, but we're sat here in fiat war. We're sat here kind of going to, you know, we're in the trenches, and it's like, hey, should we borrow against Bitcoin? It's like, well, philosophically, it feels weird. Logically, it feels fine. There's all these risks. I don't know. Let's try it and see. And I feel like our grandkids hopefully have the benefit of our mistakes and our triumphs to be able to take the world to that next level. Because I do think that lending exists in a Bitcoin standard. I think that, you know, if you're sitting on piles and piles of Bitcoin and you want to support the growth of a young entrepreneur, you're going to lend them some Bitcoin. You're going to want to help them out. You're going to want to give him the ability to give you some collateral and then give him some value back. Like, lending helps, and lending helps things accelerate a little bit faster and helps us grow the world and provide value down the line. Does it look the same as it does today? Probably not. But I do think that it'll be because of the mistakes that we make that our grandkids will have, you know, really, really good opportunities.
Yeah, I agree. I'm maybe taking this another direction. I think that sort of works on a macro scale. So I had dinner with a friend in Las Vegas, and we were talking about sort of his thesis on Bitcoin is like, fourth turning's already happened with COVID. We're like, Bitcoin's like the antibody to like, it's already been injected into the system. The system is healing effectively. And I feel like there's some max pain that needs to be experienced for people for incentives to realign, in that it's going to take a generation of people, you know, like imagine if suddenly government's just like, hey, you know what? can't afford Social Security, can't afford these welfare programs, can't afford, like, we have this whole generation right now who is, whose existence depends on handouts and no personal responsibility. Yeah. And so until that generation has to, like, learn the hard lesson that personal responsibility is really important, and their kids grow up seeing the suffering of not taking personal responsibility, it's going to be sort of this rough transition. It's not, to me, it's to say that, like, well, it's the Bitcoin is just healing the system and it's like this smooth transition. I feel like most people aren't there yet. And so you kind of hit on it, like, at a more micro level is, you know, Bitcoin families, you know, we learn, oh, I shouldn't have taken out that loan, or maybe it worked out for me. My kids are going to learn from my mistakes and my triumphs. To me, it seems like on a macro level, we're going to have, like, people are going to have to learn what it means to not accept a check from the government, because, like, the government doesn't have the power that it used to. And, like, Bitcoin has displaced the ability for a money printer. And, you know, I don't know if you have a comment on that, you're welcome to. Otherwise, it was just a random thought.
This is also a debate in my head. It's got Big Short vibes. It's like, you know, at the end of that movie, they're like, oh, we made the best trade, we're rich. And then, you know, they're kind of like, well, yeah, but the world's pretty screwed.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, okay, great. Now we get to watch our friends and family perish for the next two generations. And that's tough. Hopefully there's enough compassion, enough love, enough. I think what it comes down to is probably, hopefully there's enough mutual respect and love for the human species that we just collectively want to build it up. Not because we're forced to. Like, very, very different from a communist or a socialist or a, you know, daddy government will fix this mindset. But more, the builders recognize what needs to happen for the betterment of humanity. And hopefully, without the fiat curse, hopefully we are all comfortable enough to lend helping hands to others. Like, I know tons of wealthy individuals who are very benevolent with their money and their time for no personal gain. Usually they're like also have like a Jesus component to that. And maybe that's also like an interesting kind of observation to make. But I do feel like on a Bitcoin standard, we can absolutely support and help people. But it won't be by manipulating the system. It'll be because I understand quite well that if I give my kids a head start, they will be better off and the world will be better off because they will produce value. Like, look at me, right? Like, we just crossed a milestone, 10,000 yearly active users. So 10,000 people in the last year have bought Bitcoin, sent it directly to self-custody. They had the best experience imaginable because Bitcoin Well is obviously the best experience you can have buying Bitcoin. And they did that because I was able to take a big risk 10 years ago and start building this company. And how many tens of thousands of other people have benefited from, you know, the Bitcoin ATMs that exist. And that's because my parents worked really hard and I could take a big swing when I was 20 years old and start ripping. Hopefully my kids can take a big swing when they're 15 years old and start ripping. But I also know that if I give them too much, they're going to end up being lazy slobs. And I would just be some useless deadbeat if my parents handed me a blank check and said, yeah, go play and have fun, trust fund baby, you know, put the coke up your nose and see in, you know, see in jail. So there's like a balance that exists there. I feel like Bitcoiners naturally kind of find that balance. And we, the Bitcoiners that have the most amount of funds in the future, will be able to like find that balance in the world. The government has no balance. They are just pure inject steroids into the system and do it forever until the whole thing blows to pieces. And I feel like the balance is what's important here because probably, you know, no help. Like I had help, you had help. Everyone has help. You know, it's not if I sat here and said I built this with my, it's like, no, I didn't because I got a loan to start this company. And so yeah, like this company doesn't exist without a loan. You know, the building I'm in, we rent, but someone owns it. And guess what? They didn't pay in cash. They got a loan from someone else. And it's like, there's this whole ecosystem that exists of people. But, you know, when we went through problems 3 or 4 years ago, cause I did a poor job managing our balance sheet. Like I called the landlord and I was like, hey man, I need a hand. Like we can't pay rent for a few months. And he was like, no problem. Like good to go. Right? We'll make it up in the future. And so it's like, that didn't help him. That wasn't good at all. But he, like, you know, was willing to kind of help out in this way. And so, yeah, eternal optimist here. But I do feel like there is a world that's not maximum pain, but it's certainly a lot more pain than we have. Because right now we have no pain, and it actually, in turn, makes way more pain. And right. I think we need the right kind of pain. Like, you know, you're sore because your muscles hurt, not sore because you're 9 million pounds and can't move. And your muscles only hurt because you work out. So I think that's probably the direction that I hope the world goes, is people are able and willing to not take a handout, but to have somebody see them, invest in them, mentor them, let them make mistakes, let them fall, let them get hurt, and let them grow. And that's where I think beautiful things happen for the earth.
Yeah. I think I agree with a lot of what you just said. I think we need a self-sovereign Bitcoiner in every family.
Let's go.
So when the boat starts to sink, the life raft is available to everyone. Because as generous as I would maybe personally like to be with tons of people, like, the people who get first dibs on anything that I'm able to provide are my closest friends, my family.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like, the people in immediate proximity. And so the more people we can have who are taking self-custody, doing it the right way, strong conviction, not messing around with things that they don't understand, I think the better off we'll be.
100%.
Hey, man, I want to jump to sort of just change subjects here entirely, because we've been floating around. Well, I mean, I guess we hit a dip to what, high 70s a few months ago, and we don't talk about price a lot in this show, but I see people talking about price suppression. You've got sort of the inside look at who is buying right now. Is it, you know, whales buying OTC, you know, institutions, you know, retail? Who do you sense might be selling? Is there price suppression? Why don't you give me sort of a state of adoption as it relates to, I guess, like, Bitcoin acquisition? You know, how do you see the landscape at the moment?
Yeah, there's kind of two camps, I think. Our platform is admittedly not really built for traders. And so I am probably missing about a third of the market. If I was splitting the market up, I split it up into, like, traders, people are that are in and out chasing candles. You know, they're probably buying Bitcoin because of number go up. They're also probably likely to be buying, like, treasury companies and trading stocks on this side. That's kind of one camp. Coinbase Pro users, Kraken Pro users, you know, like, you got a Robinhood account with some leverage. Like, that's one side of the market. And we have no products for them. We can't service them. Like, so I've got a gap. I got I can't see that part of the market. But then the two camps that we serve really well is the retail camp, the plebs, the, like, you know, and I'm in this camp. Like, I buy Bitcoin 3 times a week. And it's like, this is just how, like, that's it. Like, I create value for people. They send me Bitcoin 3 times, like, you know, on certain schedules, and that's it. And there's other people that we can see these habits forming where it's like, you know, they just DCA, 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 price goes up, price goes down, they're buying Bitcoin. And that's the camp I would call the retail camp. That's our pleb camp. That's who exists there. And then there's this new camp developing, which is kind of like high net worth camps. And they're not traders, but it's like, I sold my property and I'm putting it into Bitcoin. I sold my business and I'm putting it into Bitcoin. My grandpa died and I got an inheritance check and I'm buying Bitcoin. And that camp is up for us like an infinite amount of percent. We've got, and partially because I think we're focusing on that business unit. We've got a whole team now spun up to literally drive that business unit. But that camp is bigger and healthier than ever. Lots of people coming from, you know, the Bitcoin way, coming from companies that steer them in the right direction. And lots of people right now coming from a Coinbase and saying, hey, my funds are locked. I'm pissed. I can't talk to anyone. How do I buy Bitcoin? And we're like, you send us a wire, we send it on chain directly to you, like, you're done. And that's resonating with more people than ever before. And this was kind of something that I knew was a barrier for us. I don't think I actually considered how much of a barrier it was, the self-custody piece. Like, it's an extra massive kind of hurdle for people to jump over. You can sign up for a Coinbase Pro account. You can never take custody of your coins. That sucks. But in your mind, you bought Bitcoin if you don't know better. for us, you got to, you know, you got to make a Bitcoin wallet account, and then you got to make a Bitcoin wallet. And that's scary for a lot of people. And thankfully, they've got the Bitcoin way. They've got other, you know, people in their life to show them how to do that. And we obviously do that. But it's not the same. It's one extra step. And it's a very scary and daunting step. But now, finally, this step, this extra step is working to our advantage. And you can buy, people are coming to us because we sell Bitcoin directly to self-custody, not in spite of our selling Bitcoin directly to self-custody. And that shift in the high net worth individuals is incredibly positive. Is there price suppression? Like I said, I'm probably missing the price suppressive gap because we don't serve the people that are like 100x leverage on MSTR and then aping into, you know, some like long play Bitcoin. But to directly answer your question, you know, acknowledging my bias and my like vision impairment here, yeah, there's price suppression. Like obviously there's paper Bitcoin flying around. You see the jokes on Twitter. Like if some, in a few years, if you add up all of the ETF and, you know, corporate treasury company stacks, they're gonna equal more than 21, and that's gonna be a problem. And maybe that's when the little pin, you know, pops it. And so I do think that there's price suppression going on. There's definitely some funny games happening. You know, there's settlement going on. There's definitely cracks in the armor. But hey, we talked about at the top of the show, like that's the risk, right? When you can't audit, like I know to the Satoshi how much Bitcoin me and my family owns. It's because I don't have to ask someone's permission to audit that. I just get to look and I just check the wallets. And you can't do that with a treasury company or with an ETF or anything. You know, Saylor went on some weird mental gymnastics of it being dangerous to post proof of reserves. Like there's the guy holding a meaningful percentage of the entire supply of Bitcoin, making just complete FUD. And so, yeah, I think there's absolutely price suppression going on. Add that to the list of risks with not buying real Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's going to be a wild bank run when the total amount that Coinbase says that they have is over 21 million. And everyone says,
it's not adding up million. I mean, what are they at? Are they at 2 or 3 million coins in custody right now, like alleged?
The only time I think about Coinbase is when we see news about a hack and then
every 2 weeks you're thinking about them or what?
Yeah, like every week or two we rail on Brian Armstrong on Bitcoin Banter, our show, and that's about as much as I think about Coinbase. But I think you raise an interesting, like once those numbers creep up, the interesting thing is that the average pleb isn't going to probably be thinking about that, but investors, people who have like significant capital that, you know, they hold through an ETF or, you know, somehow it ends up at Coinbase, they're going to panic, sell, eat the capital gains or whatever, and try to withdraw, you know, or try to buy Bitcoin and take it from Coinbase. And they're going to find out that maybe Coinbase didn't have it, because I agree with you. Saylor's excuse for no proof of reserves is, it's just silly.
Yeah.
I defend his right to not show proof of reserves. I think he should morally, but it's a contract that people have when they buy his stock or buy his debt or whatever. Like if they want to trust Saylor, it's a trust me, bro situation. And again, that's why I think a lot of these products kind of bother me, is because it's just like a gross violation of the ethos of Bitcoin. It's not that it shouldn't be legal. I'm a free market guy. Do what you want, but I think a lot of people end up paying this price. I've seen, Checkmate, he does like a lot of on-chain analysis. Have you seen him?
I've seen him, but I don't watch the stuff too closely.
He's an interesting guy to listen to. I think the stuff he talks about isn't generally the thing I'm most, you know, focused on. But he kind of tries to analyze this stuff. He thinks that the writing things off, writing the price suppression off, at least as paper Bitcoin, is kind of oversimplified and a bad base case for why the price is suppressed. He thinks it's a lot of like, if you look at the on-chain metrics, his analysis is, at least as I understand it, I haven't listened to him lately, but it's OGs, you know, whales selling, you know, it's like, hey, I finally want to buy that Lambo or whatever, which I can imagine. In light of our history, in light of the history of exchanges like 2022, when I got into Bitcoin, I don't see a world where there isn't paper Bitcoin being sold right now, you know? And like, that's why I like what you guys do, is because you literally can't sell paper Bitcoin. Cause if you did it, the product itself would break, you know? But yeah, I just have to imagine there's paper Bitcoin. I think the big question mark probably for both of us is, to what extent is that contributing to price suppression? Are there, you know, 20 other variables at play here that would affect it as well? But my other question for you, so you kind of talked about like the two camps that you have some visibility into. Are you seeing, and maybe you kind of said this, sorry, I was thinking a lot of things while you were talking. Are the larger OTC buys, the people who are, you know, sold their company, getting, you know, acquire, building or whatever, buying Bitcoin, are you seeing a lot more people who are buying large amounts of Bitcoin at a time? Like higher net worth people, yeah, probably generally saying like, okay, like is and is that signal to you that we're kind of like, this ship is turning in a very different direction than it's been, where people are just dollar cost averaging and a little bit at a time when they get their paycheck?
Yeah. I mean, hard to say. Like, for some people, 500K buy a couple times a year is a DCA. And that's just crazy. Part of how, you know,
God
that's
bless just,
them. Like, God bless them, man. That's just how they set their life up, which is great. I think that, largely speaking, we see more people comfortable. I see less people waiting for a price drop to buy. Previously it was like, hey, I want to buy 5 coins. Here's some cash, like limit order style. Wait till it drops 5% and then buy. And now we're seeing people understand like, hey, if I buy at 100 or if I buy at 95 or if I buy at 90, it doesn't really matter. I just want to own some for the next 20 years. And I think that we're seeing a little bit more of that mindset. Which also could be some top signals, right? People FOMOing in, people aping in. It could be a little bit less, people are less patient, maybe. But I see that as a good thing, because personally, like, the fiat value of Bitcoin, frankly, doesn't exist. Like, it is, there's a rough estimate and rough consensus around the country, around the continent, and around the globe as to what it's worth. But like, even the games that the exchanges play with, like, oh, we don't have fees, we have a spread. We don't have spread, we have these fees. It's all just kind of like made up. There is no spot price for Bitcoin. There's no such thing as a global, unified, dictated from the top down price of Bitcoin that we add, you know, 30 to 80 bips on. It's just like, we've got a consensus of a ballpark, and that's kind of it. And so I feel like people are understanding that, which means people are understanding Bitcoin, and they're comfortable just making the decision to buy Bitcoin. They're not getting greedy with like, oh, I want to wait for a 4% drop before I buy. I think there's going to be some news in 2 weeks, and CNN's going to say something, and Trump's going to respond, and we're going to see a market correction of 4%. No. Quit playing these trader games, man. Like, just buy your generational wealth, hold it properly, and do it again next week. Like, that's I think the direction. And who knows, this could be just recency bias, right? This could be because this is our marketing, this is our ethos, we're collecting like-minded customers. But it does feel like a bit of a shift from what we've had previously.
Yeah. I would be interested to have you, I don't know if this is something that we could ever pull off, but like, have you and some of the heads of other exchanges, not Brian Armstrong, don't care what he has to say, but have like you guys like, hey, like, what are you seeing? And because I feel like there's probably some signal in there. But to your point, like, your model is very different than probably the typical exchange. And I think that's a good thing. I think everyone's got blind spots. I'm just curious because, I mean, just going back to like the treasury companies, the lending products, my concern is just people getting wrecked, right? Like, I just feel terrible for people who, it's like they sort of kind of get it, like they're here for it, but then they maybe haven't really grokked the 80% freedom that you talked about, to where they're making these fiat mistakes because like the flip hasn't been fully switched. It's like they kind of started, but like the light's not on entirely. And I'm just, you know, I'm concerned for them that they're going to be the people, you know, who are waiting for a 4% dip. and they don't buy their, they never buy their generational wealth. I mean, it's like, what's the Doomberg? I remember that guy. He's like, he's waiting for Bitcoin to hit $5,000 or something, and then he might consider buying some. And it's like, dude, you've talked to enough Bitcoiners. You should understand this by now. I don't like, 5,000 is not off the table. I'm open to, like, if anything, nothing surprises me anymore. But totally. It's probably not the price point I'd be waiting on for a big buy. Like, you know.
And here's what I've noticed too about those people. Let's say Bitcoin has a 95% red candle that's under 5K. There's no chance he's pulling the trigger.
Now he's nervous. Now he's nervous. Yeah,
he's waiting for $1,000 now. Yeah. He's now waiting for $1,000. And then it goes again. It's for sure going to $1, so I'm waiting for that. You know what I mean? Like, that mindset is just, it's tough. And that's because people are so used to looking at Bitcoin as, I've collected value, and now I'm forced to choose where the value is going to go. Is it going to go into a fiat product, into a house, into some other kind of investment, or into Bitcoin? And the opposite way to think is that Bitcoin is savings. Bitcoin needs to become your default. And for you, like, this is why you're having these, like, philosophical debates and this worry for the no coiners, because, like, Bitcoin is the default. We've leveled up from the melting ice cubes. We're safe. We're good. And we have the luxury of choosing not to put our Bitcoin in something else, just knowing that it'll appreciate forever. And when Bitcoin is the default unit of value, you kind of get the best of both worlds, because price goes up, your savings are better. Price goes down, your future savings get better. And it's like perfectly aligned incentives. Whereas when you're in fiat as the default, price goes up, you've lost out. Price goes down, you're petrified. There might be a better option. And that short-term volatility is designed by the fiat demons to keep you in, like, stage 5 fright and not be able to actually participate in a worldwide, you know, sound money value transfer. But getting your mind to Bitcoin as the default, I mean, it just takes years. It takes maturity, it takes humility. It takes a few wreckage events. And like I said, people will get there. They just, the physics dictates you're going to get there. It's just whether or not it happens in your generation or in the next one.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good way of framing it. I've been so blessed to just stumble across the right people working as a client with, and that now for the Bitcoin way, just sort of like reorienting myself to some of these realities. Let's head for home, man. I told you I always ask for an unpopular opinion. You get bonus points if you offend Bitcoiners with it. You said you might have two. Is that still correct?
I'm gonna stick with one, and then you gotta bring me back for the second one, probably.
Perfect.
I think this one's gonna be juicy enough too. I'm gonna actually focus in on just the Bitcoin maxis, and it's all you sailor worshipers that I'm going to aim to offend here. If you do not sell your Bitcoin, you are not a real Bitcoiner. You absolutely need to sell your Bitcoin. And my thought process behind this is that if you don't, you've got fiat, you've got a side, you've got some kind of value sitting on the side that you get to spend elsewhere. You and I, probably everyone agrees that if you live, you're spending value. The whole ethos of Bitcoin is just the value transfer of value from me to value to you, to value to other people. And unless you're going to sit there and tell me you don't eat, you don't have shelter, you don't have clothes, and you don't have any, you know, people that rely on you, you absolutely need to spend the value that you earn. And if you are not spending Bitcoin, if you're spending fiat instead, let's say, it's because you have fiat. And by definition, if you have fiat, you can't be a Bitcoin maxi. You don't get to claim, I'm all in on Bitcoin. I've mortgaged my house. I did this, but I don't spend any of my paycheck. I keep fiat so I can buy groceries. Like, no. How about you spend Bitcoin to buy your groceries? How about you go through the brain damage of setting up a butcher to take Bitcoin? Go buy your eggs with Bitcoin. Go find a local fruit supplier, orange pill them, and then spend Bitcoin. Donald Trump, Michael Saylor ethos of, like, you know, oh, we buy our pizza with fiat. It's like, yeah, because you have fiat. And if you have fiat, you just don't get to have the, you know, the Bitcoin Maxi card. So I think that I am pretty sick of people saying that they just like, all they do is hold. I think like, you know, biblically, I actually did a whole future proof episode about what the Bible says about hoarding assets and how like negative that is for society as a whole, which is interesting. But even just from like a logic perspective, if you're going to just sit there and hoard Bitcoin and never sell anything, then again, you're forced with that decision. How much fiat do I hoard? How much fiat do I keep to spend? What if my expenses go up? Should I keep more fiat? It's like, how about you just use Bitcoin as the default? And then once the default is good and there, you then decide how much of your Bitcoin you're going to use. And we get rid of this sell terminology. You earn Bitcoin and then you use Bitcoin and the rest is savings. And we're a long way away from society, I think, grasping that. And I think we're a long way away from the sailor camp being on board with selling Bitcoin. But if you look at why he's saying that, it's like, hey, you know, if I had a stock that relied on me never using Bitcoin and only ever hoarding it, I'd want my worshipers to also do that. So
I think that was a very good unpopular opinion, and you get as many bonus points as anyone's ever received for offending other Bitcoiners. So well done. No, I agree. I think, so I'm speaking on this in Prague, and it's the importance of Bitcoin as being used as money. And obviously, I think the obvious implication of that is a store of value. I think people generally understand that. I think what most people miss is the medium of exchange and this willingness to perpetuate the fiat system by virtue of, because the way I would have framed it differently than you, I think, is it's not that you necessarily have to sell your Bitcoin, you need to spend it. But the practical reality today is you probably have to sell some of your Bitcoin in order to spend it, because right now your grocery store, again, might not accept Bitcoin. But to find like a farmer's market or, you know, some sort of local, you know, farm or, you know, whatever, like who will accept your Bitcoin, like to me, that's like the ultimate win if you can find that. And if you can be a force for making that change in the world, I think that's really important. So couldn't agree more, but you'll piss some people off. I'm looking forward to seeing the comments.
Good. And like, I welcome it because one of us is wrong, right? Maybe I'm wrong. And maybe hoarding Bitcoin and keeping fiat is the real Bitcoiner way. I just don't see the logic there. And so, yeah, zap me in the comments. You can DM me, @AdamO'Brien_ on Twitter. Come at me. Let's go. Because maybe I'm doing it wrong. I got to hoard some more fiat to be a real Bitcoiner.
No, I think it's just I think it's a matter of like, kill your heroes, man. Like, I think we've seen this over and over and over in like, I've said this before, and not to belabor your, like, this is your bonus question that you're answering, but I feel obligated to provide my commentary, because I think that what Saylor has done makes about as much financial sense as, you know, like, I think he's a financial genius.
Totally.
That said, my complaint is that morally, ethically, I would not feel comfortable doing what he's doing. I would want to take my positive cash flows. I'd want to accept Bitcoin as payment. I'd want to take existing reserves and convert that over to Bitcoin and not tell people, hey, give me your money so I can buy Bitcoin that is never owed back to you in any meaningful way. And hopefully you get to beat, you know, Bitcoin's price appreciation, dollar fiat denominated price appreciation by 20%. So that way it covers your capital gains taxes when you want to sell. It's like this whole, like, all these considerations that we've sort of talked about that I'm just like, that's not the way I'd want to go about it. And so while Saylor has a lot of smart things to say about Bitcoin, I think it's great that he's, you know, on, you know, CNBC or wherever talking about Bitcoin. Awesome. I don't love the sort of path he's taken and how he frames Bitcoin. And right. The fact on Bitcoin P today is like, you know, use your fiat, don't spend your Bitcoin. It's like,
why do you have fiat?
yeah, no. So I think it's a great point, man. All right, dude, let's wrap there. Tell people where they can find you. You mentioned your Twitter handle. Let's say it again and tell them about Bitcoin Well.
Yeah, I mean, head to @AdamO'Brien_ on Twitter. Would love for you to check out bitcoinwell.com. If you're in Canada or the US, use the platform, roast it, tell me why you hate it, and we'll make the changes if it makes sense to us. I love it when we get real feedback from people that are, you know, who I would see our target customer, which is someone that values Bitcoin for the long term, values Bitcoin in self-custody, and wants to help enable independence around the whole world. So that's us, bitcoinwell.com, and I can't wait to hear from you.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much for joining again. Look forward to catching up. Are you going to be in Prague?
No, can't get to Prague this year. I'll be in Alaska, though, in a couple of weeks, which I'm pumped on.
Okay, well, I won't see you in Alaska, but maybe I'll see you, maybe I'll see you next time. All righty, man. Good chatting. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, Michael.
Cheers. And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Adam. I know I sure did. Always great chatting with him and bumping into him at the conferences. Of course, you need to go check out Bitcoin Well. Go follow Adam on Twitter. He's an awesome guy. Awesome follow. And if you need help with Bitcoin in 100% self-custody, doing it the right way the first time, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. Schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We would love to help you, talk you through how we do it. You're going to have peace of mind like you've never had before as it pertains to securing your Bitcoin. We also help with online privacy, setting up privacy phones. We have a Plan B residency option, so that 80% of freedom that Adam was talking about, we help you run the gamut. Again, it's thebitcoinway.com/podcast. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter. We're at @thebitcoinway_. You can hit me up there as well at @theothermjordan. And if you could do me a favor, you're enjoying the show, give us a like, subscribe, comment, whatever, anything to feed the algorithm. We would really appreciate it to help other people find the show and learn more about Bitcoin and its use on the mission toward self-sovereignty. Until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.